intrusion. When are they going to stop it?
I have to say, my dear friend, I am really excited about this pod. I'm really excited.
Oh, good.
When I started putting things down on paper, it was awful, really, because I just kept thinking of other things.
Yeah.
And I think a top five is going to be so hard, you know.
As you're so enthused by the sound of it, Dave, I'm going to let you go first.
I'm going to go in right off the bat because it's the first one I've got written down here on my scrawlings, my notes. So I'm going to go in with a big kahuna documentary that was at the cinema and it ruffled a lot of feathers in the critics department, I think. And it is going to be Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man.
Right, I have heard of that, but I've never seen it. Oh. I was thinking you might put the Making of Fitzcarraldo in there.
Do you know, I've only seen half of The Making of Fitzcarraldo. Mm.
Is that where he threatens to kill Klaus Kinski or the other way around?
Well, there's another one now. You see, you've now put another documentary in my head that I haven't even written down. Oh, my God, which is My Best Fiend, the documentary about Werner Herzog and Klaus Kinski and about their difficult relationship.
Oh, yeah, that's the one, isn't it?
Brilliant. And I'd completely forgotten to mention that. It's so hard because the more I was thinking about this, the more I was thinking, God, I love documentaries. Yeah. I might love documentaries even more than I love films because really good documentary. I love a really good film documentary too, which I'm sure we're going to come to that.
The making of, exactly. Yeah.
Documentaries is such a broad subject, but this one is very much a character piece based on this gentleman called Timothy Treadwell, who just decided to put himself out in the wilderness year after year to observe grizzly bears. And he wasn't an expert.
Oh, I think I have seen this. Is this where he makes a suit?
I don't remember him making a suit. Maybe he does. Possibly does. I mean, I forgot.
Do you remember we saw that documentary where this guy designs this suit where he can withstand the grizzly bear attack?
It might be part of that, but it's part of the documentary effort. It is a long
so
time.
Funny when he's tested it.
It's hilarious, though, the way he's approaching the grizzly bears. He's got this really sort of very camp voice, hasn't he? He goes, "Hey there, Mr. Bear." He befriends this fox in it, and he's so Disney-esque. You know, he's anthropomorphic. "Hey, Mr. Chocolate. Come on now, Mr. Chocolate. Behave yourself." Oh, my God. It's so strange. And then it's got Werner Herzog's voiceover, and he said, Timothy was a childlike man who didn't realize the danger he was letting himself into. Yeah, it's a great looking documentary, and it may well have the gorilla suit, the bear suit thing. And for the life of me, though, I don't remember that. It's called Grizzly Man. But I'm sure you have seen it. I thought we'd watched it together, to be honest with you, pal.
I remember watching the one I'm talking about with you, where he designs this suit and he's getting knocked about by somebody, I think with a baseball bat or something else, who's just testing it. And it's so funny because he's just flying all over the shop. The synopsis of this one you're talking about is that does he go to live with the grizzly bear or tries to befriend them?
Yeah, he goes to live in the wilderness and deliberately sort of seeks out the company of grizzly bears, right, which is, for all intents and purposes, to everybody else who knows anything about grizzly bears or any grizzly bear expert, he's certainly no grizzly bear expert. He's a failed actor who nearly got the job of Woody in Cheers. It was down to him and Woody Harrelson, and he didn't get the job, right? So instead of becoming a sort of TV personality, he decided he was going to become like an adventurer. And so he was on people like Letterman. He was interviewed because he used to do it time and again. He got notoriety for what he was doing. And he filmed lots of it. So the bear suit bit may well have been within within the film. It's probably a bit bizarrely a bit I don't remember.
Well, it was actually an anti-bear suit, so it was to apparently withstand the attack.
It probably is from it, and I'm
right. I'm just looking up a documentary here. I think it might be Project Grizzly.
I think it's a different film then, yeah. Because I'm thinking I couldn't remember that from this one.
This worth one checking out anyway. Very funny.
I will. That's Project Grizzly. That sounds amazing.
I'm sure we watched it together, Dave.
Oh, it sounds incredible. But I was listening to an interview with a young man who had been attacked by a bear and barely survived this bear attack on some podcast I was listening to. And it's horrendous. He said he could hear his skull crushing in its jaw. And he felt his eye pop out of its socket, you know. Well, ultimately, and I'm sorry, guys, spoiler alert here, but Timothy Treadwell and his then-girlfriend, who decided to come with him on this and what was to be this fateful last adventure, went out there to meet the grizzlies. And Mr. Chocolate, the fox... Naughty Mr. Chocolate, taking all my things, Mr. Chocolate. He had this like really high pitched voice. And they went out, and it's quite prophetic because I think Dave Letterman said, God, you're going to get yourself killed doing this. You're going to get yourself killed. And literally, that's what happened, I think, on the very trip after this interview. He went back.
He got killed.
He got absolutely. Him and his girlfriend got absolutely annihilated by the grizzlies in the end.
Fucking hell.
And there is awful. What is awful? Because he used to film it all. He filmed all the... I'm sorry, I'm not laughing here, but because it's really quite harrowing at the end. The camera is still... The VCR is still running while he's getting attacked by the bear, and you can hear the screams and everything. And Herzog... listens to it all. He said he was so haunted. This is in the documentary because he doesn't play it. No, he didn't. He didn't put it out. He put the film out, but he would not put the screams of Timothy Treadwell and his girlfriend out because he said it was just heartbreaking and horrendous, you know, the end of it. But it's a fabulous documentary because he didn't take some fabulous wildlife photography, especially of these bears like going at it with each other, you know, for dominance. But he put himself, he was very, very naive, and he just put himself in harm's way without realizing.
Yeah,
he just thought he could make
a bit of a stupid idea from the off.
Oh, it was.
Rip your face off.
Absolutely.
This grizzly.
And even though he kind of said he knew they were wild and knew they were dangerous, he sort of anthropomorphized them. He kind of thought that they were his friends. You know, not really. They're a wild animal. And one change of instinct within a moment. You know, you can't tame something really like a grizzly bear, I don't think. They're just too wild. You know, yeah, I mean, you know, from birth, perhaps, you know, if you're brought up with the cub, or the cub's brought up with you, rather. But yeah, it's a tragic, very funny at times. You know, he's sadly quite funny, Treadwell, you know, Treadwell character. But it's very poignant and ultimately very really tragic, you know. So yeah, I think brilliant documentary. And Werner Herzog, great filmmaker. But anyway, I'm shutting up now. And I'm going to pass the baton over to you, sir.
Okay, thanks. Well, I'm going to pick a pretty uplifting story. And I saw it with you. And I just felt really, really good afterwards for quite a long time. You know, we're talking 4 or 5 days up to a week. And that is the story of Anvil. Or Anvil,
oh, my
the
God.
Story of Anvil.
There it is. There it is.
Have you got it?
That was going to be my fourth entry. There it is, right there. Anvil, the story of Anvil, directed by Sasha Gavassi.
Yeah, who is the father of Jerry Halliwell's first child, I believe.
Ah, I didn't know that. We met him.
He did, we met
along
we met
with
them.
Anvil.
Well, we didn't meet Anvil, but...
Yeah, we did, didn't we? Because he introduced the film. Well, we didn't meet them personally.
Yeah, they came up.
We watched them play a gig.
Well, two songs.
I think it was three songs and two or three. That's a gig by Anvil, as far as I'm concerned.
Pretty much, yeah. I'll let you have that, Dave. Yeah, so we went to like this premiere of it in Manchester at the Corner House Theatre.
Brilliant, wasn't it, mate?
There, but so Sasha Gervaisi, he introduced the film and. Afterwards, he did a Q&A and the band came on. and played a few songs. So it was a great night all round. And then afterwards, we had a bit of a chat with him, the director. And I remember buying the latest CD, which is the one that they made in the film, on the way out, which is a pretty good album. I mean, I knew about Anvil before we saw the film, but I'm going back to the 80s when they were in the heyday, really. I never really took much notice of them. They were a pretty straightforward metal band. And because they were Canadian, they didn't seem to have a lasting impact in the UK. But I was always aware of them. I didn't actually know they were still going through the 90s and beyond. But it was such a surprise, the film, wasn't it? Because it was so poignant. I think that's the best word I could use to describe it, because it was basically about their continued failure, but their unwillingness to give up.
What I loved about it, Lee, as well, at the time, I was putting together that, like, my one-man show, which was called Life of a Failed Pop Star.
Oh, yes.
I did end up performing it, and I'm so glad that I was able to do that in the end. And it was good, you know, it really worked. But I remember thinking, God, this is fantastic, because I was doing something that they had done on a kind of historic, incredible level, because they had tried and tried and tried over years, ultimately failing and still persevering with the band, still going, still trying all those years later, even though after their initial success, they still had to go back and get jobs and look after
That's
their
it,
families.
Because it opens up with quite a comical moment where you've got the singer and guitarist who's nicknamed Lips driving this catering van, and he's talking about shepherd's pie and other meals that they do. And you think, what's happening here? But then it's revealed that that's his job. And the drummer, who's the other guy, Rob Reiner, quite ironically called, I thought, given that he's very close to Spinal Tap, he's got a job in construction or something. But they still obviously are doing Anvil, though you can tell that Lips is the driving force behind them, and he really drags Rob along, because there's times when Rob gets very demoralized and he doesn't like getting humiliated, because throughout the film they end up going on this European tour, which is an absolute disaster,
yeah,
and they're playing to like crowds of two people, and they're getting ripped off by promoters, they're getting lost in, you know, some European city they've never been to, and they miss the train and all sorts of things go wrong. And you could understand how humiliating and demoralising it would be. But Lips, he just keeps dragging them back up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And it's his spirit that comes through in the film.
Amazing spirit and enthusiasm. Yeah. And there are elements of it that are almost like too good to be true in the humour. Because, you know, the paintings bit around the house. Spinal Tap. It is so... Yeah. It's beyond Spinal Tap. It's that brilliant. And you're kind of thinking, is he being ironic here? Is he actually being kind of knowingly ironic and jokingly kind of rock god Spinal Tap making these crazy paintings that he's got around his house? And he wasn't, you know, he's been sincere. And that's kind of part of, and it's really such a charming film.
It is.
It's a great choice, Lee. And again, I told you, it was my choice as well.
Well, I'm chuffed it is your choice, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely, brother. Yeah. I mean, it's like one of the best. It's just so good. Oh, that's great.
You know, there was always this suspicion, and I think Anvil did have this suspicion a bit, is that they were being exploited a little bit by the director, Sasha Gervais, who was actually a personal friend, because his story starts when he was about 15 and he toured with the band. He just asked if he could come along because he was such a fan. And I think when he started filming them, and he filmed so much footage apparently, that he could see that he had a bit of gold here. But it was very much based on the fact that they were a failure. So I think particularly Rob, the drummer, was a bit concerned about the way they were being portrayed, because, you know, I've heard some reviewers cruelly say that they are just deluded and pathetic, which I think is completely missing the point of doing something for the sake of doing it. You know, they couldn't give up making music and playing music.
I just think it was, they had such passion. They really did. They really genuinely wanted it so bad.
And they did have a bit of a resurgence after the film, you know.
Yeah, I think that was one. That was what's wonderful about it, the wonderful thing.
So they got, you know, even though at times they were made to look stupid and a bit foolish in the film, I think they did benefit from that ultimately. A bit like the Bros one, you know the Bros one that came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they just look absolutely ridiculous.
Sure.
But they rode that wave, didn't they?
They did.
Because it got them back in the public eye.
They did. And they ended up doing gigs.
And they capitalised on it.
Capitalised on it. But the great thing with Anvil was, the difference is that Ross had this supersonic success.
Despite being the shittiest band ever.
Absolutely. But despite being terrible. But Anvil never did. Even though many, many rock stars thought they should have been. You know, they thought they were really potentially great. But the fact that they gained their notoriety, that they got their songs out there into a larger public arena than they'd ever had through the irony of this documentary about failure. It's kind of what I was trying to strive to do in my one-man show, and they succeeded beautifully with that. I thought that was fabulous.
I'm just reading here, Dave, that Ian Anderson, who was one of Lips's heroes, bumped into him at Heathrow Airport, and he told him that the movie had completely inspired him to keep playing music.
Oh, wow.
And that he just kept thanking me for all the inspiration my band gave him.
Oh, you know what?
I mean, that must have made his life to hear
that. That must have made his life. Heroes. You know what? Ian Anderson, it's a good lad doing that. Really, really good.
Yeah.
I think I felt personally inspired to carry on with that project that I was doing. And ultimately, I did perform it. And it was, and you know what? It was really successful. I only stopped doing it really because my then manager Vicky, she moved away, and we had George, and George and I just decided the idea was I was just going to shelve it for a bit and go back to it. So I keep sort of threatening to do it again because it's the kind of thing I could do at any age really. So I keep saying I will do it again someday, but...
Well, it was brilliant, Dave. I loved the songs.
Oh, thanks, mate. That's great.
Never actually got to see it myself, did I?
Well, ironically, nobody got to see the very last one, which was by far the best performance. Sutty's pal, Matthew Corbett, saw it.
Matthew Corbett. Fantastic. But,
and it was a really good, really good turnout. And everybody thought it was really funny and, laughed all the right places and clapped to the songs. And I was on cloud nine and I just had George and I drove back home to see my little boy and see my wife. And it was just kind of thinking to myself, so ironic, this is one of the best, like, as far as a performer goes, one of the best nights I've ever had in my life. And nobody that I really love or care about has been here to see it. That's how it goes, isn't it? Sometimes.
Yeah. Right. So, in a way, you've done your next choice, haven't you, with agreeing with me on Anvil? So,
well, what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to go down a sporting avenue because I'm only going to put one sporting documentary. I've decided none of it. There's not going to be one to do with football, even though A Night in Turin's really good. I'm going to mention that. It's a really good documentary. You might have picked that. I don't think you have. I'm pretty sure, though, you have picked a football documentary. And I think I know which
one
it is.
You know me too well.
I know which one it is. But I'm not doing anything to do with football. I'm going to mention also a great little documentary called The People's Champion about Alex Higgins, which is a great documentary about his crazy life. What a strangely mercurial person he was. What an amazing talent he was. And I think that's a fabulous little 50-minute documentary made by the BBC. Very well worth a watch if anyone gets a chance to see it.
Part of the that three-part that was on?
No, different. That was great. But they did show The People's Champion in amongst that. That was the Gods of Snooker trilogy of documentaries, which is an excellent series of documentaries. If you like your snooker and your Q sports of any kind, watch that. It's great. And it's full of like interesting characters. But obviously, Alex Higgins sort of transcends the sport itself as a character, as in a way, funnily enough, his nemesis does. Steve Davis. Steve Davis transcends the world of snooker because he's into so many other things. He's an amazing DJ. He's in a prog rock synth band. Steve Davis is an amazing character.
I didn't know he was in a prog rock synth band. Because he's promise his music. You. He's always been into like Motown and stuff, hasn't he? Soul music.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got one of the biggest collections of Northern Soul in the world, apparently. And he did do a lot of Northern Soul DJing. But he absolutely loves prog rock. And he loves really spaced out kind of music. And he's actually been in a band called Utopia Grand or something. Anyway, just look
what
it up.
What does he play?
I'll tell you now. He plays like this kind of... he doesn't play an instrument so much as he plays like a synth machine.
A guitar.
He puts plugs in different things, a little bit like Pete Townsend with Barbara O'Reilly, where he's messing about with the machine. And he's got a lot of like proggy musician mates. Because it's fucking crazy. Listen to his music, man. It is fucking far out, Lee. I promise you. He's an amazing guy. In other media, music. Okay. Yeah, music. When in sixth form at school, Davis began listening to progressive rock and was introduced to the Canterbury scene, which immediately fascinated him. I love the bands like Soft Machine and Henry Cow. Robert Wyatt. They said Wyatt Earp. But his biggest fan, he's a massive, massive fan of the French progressive rock band Magma.
I have heard of Magma.
He was so into Magma that he paid for them to come over and play in London. Right? Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
Utopia Strong. They're called the Utopia Strong. Right?
Sounds like an X Factor band name.
Oh, no, tell you what, the last thing it is like X Factor. Oh, here it is. This is the one. This is one I think is quite good. Listen to this.
Being played on a stylophone.
It's like Next Dead Minimalist. It's like so trippy. It's like Acid House. And you want to see the video to it, Lee, as well. So, God, you've got to love Steve Davis, haven't you? You've just got to love him. He's a genuine British eccentric. And I love him for that.
Yeah.
And he's funny.
I always feel dead guilty for supporting Dennis Taylor in the 1985 final.
Yeah, because you just think he's like a fucking...
Steve is the dude.
Steve is the dude, and you just think of Taylor's a bit of a sort of cheap Frank Carson.
Twat. Yeah.
Didn't
Alex Higgins threaten to...
Shoot him.
Shoot him.
He threatened to shoot him.
Belfast kiss.
You can take your snooker and you can shove it up your ass because I ain't playing anymore. And Dennis, I'm going to fucking blow your brains out. Amazing. Amazing. Apparently, he would appear. Higgins would appear, you know, at some tournament and people would just disappear. You know, all the players. And they just... We're terrified of him because he's like the Begbie of snooker. You know, he didn't know what to expect.
Do you remember when he went on that bender with Oliver Reed?
Yeah, exactly.
Imagine witnessing that.
I think now, having gone on about this documentary about the People's Champion, I'm going to choose this. I'm going to honourably mention, I'll come back to it. I'm going to honourably mention a couple of cricket documentaries, which I absolutely love. I was going to pick. I've changed my mind. Boom, like this. I've changed my mind in mid-sentence. Because I was going to pick the fabulous documentary. I recommend anyone to see it. Called Fire Over Babylon. About the West Indian team of 1976. When they came over to Britain. It's a great documentary. Tony Gregg was bragging that, you know, when they start to lose, they go on the fucking knees. They don't like it, like this. And... The West Indies thought, right, we're not having this South African, white South African twat talk to us like that. And they saw red and they played literally out of their skin. And it's full of great footage of Michael Holding bowling at 100 miles an hour at Brian Close, who looks not 40, but looks about 65, like he should be smoking a pipe on the pitch with this lithe, amazing, athletic guy running into bowl at him. and delivering these torpedo deliveries at him, and Brian Clough's not been able to hit the ball. No helmets, very little protection. This incredibly
gifted... No helmets. You can't believe it, can you?
You can't fucking believe it.
I mean, that is like putting your life at risk.
Oh, Lee, I don't know what to choose now, because I'm talking about this and thinking how great this is. Talking about the Alex Higgins one, thinking how great that is. Oh, no. And I was going to mention also The Edge. Fabulous stuff.
Yeah, you've told me about that. I meant to watch that, but then it was annoyingly taken off the Amazon or Netflix. As always happens.
Yeah, they do. After a certain time, they go, oh, and take it off now. You can't watch
it's
it
good,
now.
This. It's good, this. We can't have this on.
Yeah, exactly. This is way too good. You know, we've got to leave you a few shitty films to watch that you've seen 20 times, paying your subscription, or you can watch our own stuff, which is shit. Shit! Honestly, it's such a con, isn't it? Yeah. Streaming, fucking these streaming channels, con.
Every time you think, oh yeah, I fancy watching that, let's see if it's on Netflix or Amazon. No, it's not.
And you try to find a decent film, you're just scrolling through, aren't you? It's like, I've seen that, seen that, seen that.
Yeah, I think they're just going to release a scrolling version of Netflix. $2.99 a month.
Yeah, $3.99 just so you could just scroll through at night looking at trailers and stuff you've seen.
Yeah. Oh, increasing disappointment.
So The Edge is a brilliant documentary. It's a brilliant documentary about mental health as much as anything else as well. It's not just about cricket. It's about sports people reaching this crescendo of success and then falling to bits because they just, it's too much. It becomes too much.
Understandably.
Understandably. And I think cricket is a great game for that. I mean, there's a lot of mental health problems in cricket because the greatest cricketer in the world at the moment, let's be honest, Ben Stokes, he's kind of said, I need a time out. I need to get my head sorted out. I've got mental health issues. Yeah.
But at least he doesn't do it mid-match.
No, he's not done it mid-match.
Like certain athletes who were not doing very well in their particular sport.
Yeah, I'm a bit dubious about that, I have to say.
Yeah.
But then you've got people, you see, this is the thing, suddenly they can drop out. But in cricket, you get someone like Jonathan Trott, who suddenly went into this dark, dark depression in the middle of an Ashes test in Australia, facing Mitchell Johnson, who's releasing balls at 95 miles an hour. And this guy, this brilliant cricketer, you know, Jonathan Trott, brilliant, brilliant cricketer, just lost it. He completely lost it. And he got so much criticism. Everyone just thought he was scared. Everyone just thought he was terrified. This guy who'd already knocked loads of centuries together, had a fabulous average, was doing the business. I think, listeners, you can see I'm quite interested in cricket, quite passionate about it, but and snooker. But he lost it and retired. He literally retired from Test cricket straight after that. I mean, it was so sad, really sad. I think what people forget with cricket is it's a long game. I think you need super dedication to the game to even be a cricketer to start off with, because every game lasts literally all day. That's why I gave it up in the end, because it's like all day. You know, you'd have to dedicate. A football match is 90 minutes. You can do other things. You've got to be cricket. You've got to be kind of there all the time. Now, imagine that. And then you're on a 3 months tour and then you come home, you're back with your family for 2 weeks and then you're off playing county cricket. And then you're called up for the England side again. And then it's one day games. And there's so much more of it now than there was. There's loads of it. And you can sort of see why people have these sort of mental breakdowns. Yeah. As a consequence. So this is a fabulous documentary showing that aspect of sport. And Fire Over Babylon is a fantastic documentary that talks about the social climate. It's a sociological as well as a psychological documentary, because it talks about the psychological passion of the West Indian cricketers in this very difficult social time in Britain, where there was a lot of bitterness on the street, you know, black people were being ghettoised and treated pretty badly. It was a fantastic way for the West Indian community to sort of see heroes emerge against the imperialistic, you know, British people, if you like. Let's be honest, that's the truth. And it's a fantastic story of a place in time in British culture. So it's
what year did it come out then, approximately?
I think Fire Over Babylon was actually released in the early about 2010, 2011.
Oh, really? But what period was it depicting?
1976.
Okay.
So it's the tour when the West Indies came to England in 1976. And Tony Greig and the English team really thought they were going to beat the West Indies. But in the end, you look at the two teams from what we know now, and they just overpowered, you know, the English team. Viv Richards scored 900 runs in like five or six test matches, averaging nearly 100, over 100, you know. And that's when that was the start of Viv Richards' enormous fame. What, probably one of the most known sportsmen in the world in the 1980s, wasn't he, really, I would imagine?
Yeah,
Viv Richards.
Yeah.
Most people knew who Viv Richards was, you know, unless you lived in America, perhaps, you know. You know, cricket is very much a colonial sport, isn't it? It's about the countries that we went and conquered and decided to, you know, give them a bit of liberty. So it was a big thing to come to what the West Indian players call the motherland and just shatter not our stumps, but our dreams. Oh, that's a good line, Dave. Boom.
That's a good line, Dave.
I'm dropping the mic, baby.
So which are you having for your choice?
Oh,
so
my God.
Got the Edge, you've got that, and you've got the Alex Higgins one.
I don't know.
No. You're going to have to pick.
Because when you were going on about Alex Higgins and Oliver Reed, and also the thing with Alex Higgins, Gareth and I went to see the one-man show about Alex Higgins, which was incredible, which starred the guy who went on to play in the TV series Fortitude. He'd done a lot of other things. But it was a brilliant, brilliant performance. He transformed himself into Alex Higgins, not just the young Alex Higgins that was virile and irascible and full of energy, but also the old, cancerous, withered Alex Higgins. It was a transformative performance. And seeing Higgins in that documentary as the withered old man, and then flashbacks to his youth and his brilliance as a young...
Do you mean Richard Dormer?
Richard Dormer, correct.
He was in Game of Thrones as well.
Game of Thrones as well. He was the guy who did that. That's how he became famous. That's how he ended up getting the roles he's got.
Right.
Because he won huge critical acclaim for his one-man show with Alexis. And again, linking to Life of a Failed Popstar, I wouldn't have done Life of a Failed Popstar if it hadn't been seeing Richard Dormer play Alex Higgins on stage at the Lowry Centre. So there's another link. And nice, it makes me want to go, I'm picking the Higgins.
You're picking Higgins?
But I'm being an awkward twat and I'm saying, it's an honourable mention and I'm going to pick Fire Over Babylon. Just because it's much more of a cultivated film. It was a cinema release film, as was The Edge, really. The Edge, too. It's the textures and colours and the social statements within it that make it such a brilliant documentary. So, yeah, I'm going to stick with my original choice. I've changed my mind again, and I'm going Fire Over Babylon. But it shows you how much I love those three documentaries.
Right, good. I'm going to play you something now, Dave, for my next choice.
Go on.
Now, I'm sure you're familiar with this. If I can... load it up, just bear with us.
Oh, hey, this is Mike Reed on Classic FM. Do you know, if only there was somebody here to make me a comment, the world will be a better place.
I'm sorry, I've got to turn the radio off. I can't listen to his voice.
It's 9:09, but then again, it would be.
I can't listen to him. That's right, just for going. Straight off. Oh, this is how his voice. What happened?
Did you hear that, Dave?
Yeah, I did, but I'm a bit, because my headphones aren't particularly good, the ones I'm using tonight. I'm still a bit, I thought you were going down the Taylor route there, but the Graham Taylor, I thought it was all about. Go on, anyway. Tell me, I'll shut
up. So that is, if you didn't recognise it, that is a woman having a virtual, almost an orgasm by the sound
that's
of
funny, I thought
the
it
voice
was.
Of Saturday Superstar presenter and DJ Mike Reed.
Oh. Guess what this is?
Do you remember her?
Oh, my God.
So this was... I feel almost bad highlighting this because she was quite mentally ill.
No, it's not, because League of Gentlemen did it. League of Gentlemen.
League of Gentlemen did reference it, of course, yeah.
Oh, so, brilliant. Forgotten all about this.
Yeah, this documentary was called I'm Your Number One Fan, and it was basically about stalkers and obsessive fans. It was about three or four people that they covered. One had an obsession with Stephen Hendry.
Stephen Hendry, yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's what I was just going to say very quickly. I was going to say that one of the things about Alex Higgins was that his new nemesis after Hendry got so good was Hendry. So he started liking Davis in the end. So he'd go up to Davis and said, have you seen the cunt yet? See, and apparently as soon as Stephen Hendry saw him, he would like run away. He used to run away from him.
Oh yeah. I can imagine Higgins hating him.
He hated him. He used to go up to him and call him a prick.
One of the fans featured was obsessed with Stephen Hendry.
I remember
another guy was obsessed with Princess Diana. So at that point she may have died, I can't remember.
Yeah,
but he was being very threatening towards the Queen and the royal family, kept saying that if you look into a £5 note you can depict satanic references.
And well, he might have a point. He
was like drawing horns and things like that on the Queen's head. And there was another one that was sort of not that scary but a bit weird. This woman that was and a daughter that were really into Cliff Richard. But the star of the show,
without doubt,
was a woman who was in her mid-40s, I think, at the time, called Blue Tulip Rose Reed.
Amazing.
Now, the reason she came up with that name is because she went around saying that she was married to DJ and TV presenter Mike Reed.
Not Frank Butcher, Mike Reed.
Yeah, UKIP supporter. Saturday Superstore, Radio 1 or 2 DJ, the twat who banned Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah. What you right? think? Yeah. Mulleted bigot Mike Reed.
Yeah.
Right. Not the soap opera bald bigot Mike Reed.
Yeah. Not Frank. I'm going to play another clip now, in which Blue Tulip Rose Reed explains how she became to love Mr. Mike Reed.
Oh, this is so funny. Oh my God.
I went to the BBC. And someone pipes up and says, Mike Reed's here. I thought, not my favourite DJ of all times. I was flabbergasted. Just as we were about to go out, I was about to go out the door, I saw this gorgeous looking guy. I thought, oh my good God, I thought, he's an absolute cracker. So I turn around and says to him, is your name Mike Reed? Just like that. He said, yes, because it was with Ed Stewart. Ed Stewart's breath stinks. Mike Reed is absolutely gorgeous. He is fantastic. He is tops. He was wearing his beautiful blue shorts, corduroy shorts. He was wearing a blue shirt. I playfully tap Mike's bum. Tenders! Talk about the electricity going through me! I never felt anything like it in my life. And I thought, yeah, that's it. That's a guy for me. I thought, yes. He is everything to me. He is very, very, very precious to me. There is no guy I've ever loved in this world until I fell for Mike. Mike Reed, husband, dearest, eat your heart out, okay?
Unbelievable. That is, I think that's it. Let's just call it a night. That it's the best documentary of all time. Because I remember watching it and just crying all the way through with laughter. Because it's so funny.
Well, you know, there at the end, she's doing this dog routine that she's singing along to a song as a dog.
Yeah.
She actually, and I didn't know this until recently, she actually turned up on Britain's Got Talent.
Wow.
You know, doing the same act, singing along as a dog.
Gotta see that. Fantastic.
It's on YouTube.
Oh, brilliant.
so much good stuff from that documentary. There was one that was hilarious where she's actually writing a letter to Mike Reed, and she's put his name and address on the envelope, but she's covered it in spunking cocks. Do you remember?
I remember.
And she's also, she encloses a picture of a washing machine, and she says, "Mike, this is my washing machine. I've called it Mike Reed."
Oh my God.
I mean, I don't know how it ended, but I think he must have got some sort of injunction out, because she was absolutely terrifying. She also wears T-shirts that she's had made up with Mike Reed printed on them. And also messages on there, some of them quite explicit, quite sexual. Well, probably one of the funniest bits is when she goes into one of these printing places and she asks for this T-shirt or sweatshirt to be made up. And the counter inadvertently upsets her with a casual, if careless, remark.
Yeah.
I'd like a nice T-shirt printed, please. And I'd like that on it.
And who's that?
That is my husband, Mike Reed.
Your husband?
Yes, it is.
Can I take your name?
Mrs. Mike Reed. When can I get in bed with you?
When can I get in bed with you?
Yeah.
So even though you've married him, you've not slept with him yet, correct?
No, not yet.
Okay, I'll just get one of the boys to run that off on the printer.
Oh, lovely. Oh, and can I have it done in blue, please?
Definitely.
Nice and bold.
I thought he was gay.
Hey! Hey! Now, you can pack that in as soon as you like. I should think so too. Nobody calls him gay. Nobody. Ever. I'm sorry, that hurt. No, that hurt.
Oh, God.
That is fucking brilliant.
The bastard saying that. That hurt.
I was gay. Dead cash. I was gay.
No! You can stop that as soon as you like.
Stop that as soon as you like.
That hurt.
No! Oh my God, that is the funniest. Do you remember? I remember when you showed us that documentary when we were on holiday in the Highlands of Scotland, and we all sat and watched it, and I think every single person who watched that was crying with laughter. It was just so funny, you know. It is an hilarious documentary, whichever way you look at it, I'm sorry, but it is.
Don't think it'd be allowed to be made today.
It would be
seen as exploiting somebody with serious mental health problems, which, you know, I do kind of feel a bit bad laughing at it, but
it's hilarious.
You can't help it, you know.
It's
funny at the end of the day.
It's funny.
It's not funny that she's that deluded. I feel sorry for her.
I mean,
she picked Mike Reed of all people to be obsessed with. That's funny in itself.
Of course. She's a bit kind of, she's an eccentric.
She might just be eccentric. I mean,
she's got some kind of mental health possibly, but she's really playing up to the whole bloody thing, you know, and she's very, you know, she's like a sort of fat Sue Pollard, isn't she?
She does look a bit like a...
Hey, do you know what?
Fat Sue Pollard.
Like loud in her face.
But I was just remembered when she turned up on Britain's Got Talent, she called herself Blue Tulip Edelweiss Digby. Something.
She's obviously moved on to the bigot Mike Reed.
She stopped stalking Mike.
Yeah.
Got divorced.
Yeah. I'm not married to him now. I'm married
he's
to
gay. Dick. I found out he's
dog
gay.
In the world. Yeah, he's gay. Found out he is gay. I saw him, I said you can stop that if you like.
He was fucking my washing machine.
Which has his name, which is like incest.
You know, I've got to say, the 90s, I watched a lot of documentaries during the 90s, and they were always brilliant documentaries then. They don't seem to make the same type of docs anymore.
No.
You know, although they're a bit sanitised, aren't they, if they do cover strange subjects like that.
Absolutely. And I think this is kind of a nice way to segue into my next choice, I think, because I think my next choice is a Channel 4 documentary. It's very rarely shown. I even had to go back into like YouTube's archives to find out what it was called.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking it was late 90s. It might have been early 2000s. But all around that period of time, like you say, early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, you would get some great documentaries about a variety of subjects done in quite a sort of dry and pithy way. But ultimately, I think this documentary is about a very serious thing, a very serious matter. It's also a fantastically eccentric British story in some ways as well. So my next choice is going to be, and I'm going to give a couple of honourable mentions around this, if that's okay, is going to be Britain's Closest Encounter, the Rendlesham Forest documentary.
Oh, yeah. I did see that.
And I just thought what was so good about this as a documentary was that it looked at the whole story from lots of different angles. It looked at the kind of Hetty Wainthrop type investigation by Dot Street and Brenda, name escapes me, and the incident itself, the quote-unquote UFO incident that took place at Rendlesham Forest that involved many, many American airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you get the debunking angle, of course,
yeah,
within the documentary. And you get some local eccentrics. You get the full gamut. It's a wildly British documentary. I spoke about the Rendlesham Forest incident a couple of podcasts ago.
Yeah, it was on the Todmorden one.
On the Todmorden one. And it's been a much talked about, a much told story. But it was the first time that I personally had ever... I think I'd heard about it many years before, actually,
mm-hmm.
on, I think it was the Michael Aspel Unsolved Mysteries show.
Oh, yeah, I remember
out of the BBC. And they did a good job on it. But this documentary really sort of galvanizes all the characters together, galvanizes how it was tried to be kept secret for a long time in the base, you know, in Ipswich.
Yeah.
It also then talks about how these amateur sleuths decided to try and crack the case. They knew something strange had been going on through the local rumor mill, and they forced the deputy commander of the base to fess up to what had happened. And since then, the legend has just grown and grown and grown and grown. And the other person that got involved in it, of course, was Jenny Randalls, she's a big sort of parapsychologist, who I kind of has pulled away from it all now. I don't think she's quite as big a fan of the story, but it's a fabulously eccentric British story that involves a lot of Americans, basically.
Mm, yeah, it's a good choice, that. It's it was a really good, well-told documentary, as I remember.
Yeah. Something happened at Rendlesham. Was it a mass hallucination? If it was, it's fascinating. Something happened at Rendlesham. It must have done. What happened? Who knows? You know, it's a fascinating case. It's not as cut and dried, and it's not as perhaps as believable as some of the other ones. There's one particular deactivation of an American base by a senior member of the army who will talk about this quite freely now, and his story is really compelling. This is really kind of scary. And actually, it's not scary, it's pretty brilliant stuff, because if they're deactivating nuclear weapons, maybe we have got a guardian angel after all, you know, to me. This is a brilliant thing. But something odd happened at Rendlesham. Maybe they all ate some really off food and they all went into some kind of crazy, you know, this idea of like a certain mold on bread can give you hallucinatory dreams or something. Well, maybe something like that happened, who knows. But something strange happened. For, you know, army personnel who are supposed to be trained observers to all kind of freak out like they did at Rendlesham. But it was covered up. It was kept hush hush. It was kept in house until Street and Butler and Randalls decided to eke out the information. So much so, in the end, Holt gave in, told his story, and it ended up going to the House of Parliament, and that was spoken about in the House of Parliament because of the big tabloid newspaper run on it. And even Thatcher gave a nod and a wink about it, as if to say, shh, there's things you don't need to know. Quick mention, and then I'll let go of this. James Fox, the American documentarian who makes ufology films, he's brought out this new one called Phenomenon. I really want to see it because it's all about the latest Pentagon stuff and the Tic Tac and all the very, very compelling modern day information that's slowly coming out. But he made a film a few years ago called I Know What I Saw, which is a terrific documentary, again, about ufology. I want to mention the, again, on the sort of esoteric and paranormal, the Enfield Poltergeist documentary that Channel 4 did. Again, Channel 4, really good documentary, that. And the Richard D. Hall, who's, you could say, an amateur filmmaker, but he researches things, whether you like him or not, he researches things very deeply. And his documentary about the Berwyn Mountain incident. So I just wanted to mention them. And I'm just going to say that my fourth choice is Britain's Closest Encounter.
Excellent. Right. So the one I'm going to pick is a QED from 1989. QED was on the BBC. Great. And I was actually surprised that this was from 1989 because I did think it was a bit earlier than that. And it's about this guy called John Davidson. And he's a 16-year-old lad from Gala Shields in Scotland who has severe Tourette's syndrome.
Oh, I nearly mentioned it in the... When you were just talking about Blue Tulip Rose Reed, I was going to equate how when we watched John's Not Mad at School, we'd all go in the next day laughing our heads off about it, because you did at that age.
Well, that's funny that you said you saw it at school, but you would have left school by 89, wouldn't you?
Why do I think that then?
This is why I thought that, Dave. I thought it was about out in about 85.
Fuck, I thought I was at school. Yeah.
Well, it says on the Wikipedia that it was out in 89.
I thought I'd gone to school and we were all talking about the next day, spitting on his chips and telling his mum to fuck off.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Exactly what he does. Poor John. I mean,
it's an amazing guy.
He's
really
a lovely guy. He's a lovely guy because they did a follow-up documentary on him when he was 30. There were two follow-ups, one when he was 30 and one when he was 37. And he comes across as the sweetest, loveliest guy you could ever meet. But my God, when he was 16 and he was going through puberty, you know, your heart just went out for him because he was inadvertently blurting out sexual things in front of his mum, because obviously that's on his mind, isn't it? 16 years old.
It's unbelievable. It's so tragic in a way. But you know, he'd walk in like you see an old woman in like the supermarket and you're, oh bitch or something, you know, like, and like, you just can't.
Well, one of the main scenes is him shopping with his mum in the supermarket, and it's just very, again, you feel bad.
It's bad, just, but very comical. Help laughing.
Where he's going, oh, what tea bag should I get, mum? Fuck off, you cunt, you know.
It's amazing. It's like, what's funny, the reason why it was funny, though, is because we were exposed in that documentary to Tourette's for the first time. I don't think anybody, I'd never even heard of it.
No, you're right.
And so it was kind of shocking and funny. It was funny. It was really funny because There's no getting away from it. You see someone with Tourette's for the first time, it's funny because they just let rip of the first thing that comes in. You know, it's an indictment of us as human beings because our first reaction, someone sees me for the first time, you go, they probably think, bald cunt, bald cunt. You know what I mean? That's the first thing in their head. But it's just kind of like, it's that idea of like, everybody's kind of bigoted. You know, really, everybody. Yeah. I remember we were talking about this in when I was a learning support assistant, and the lecturer was brilliant. What they were saying is that everybody can't. It's almost like you can't help it. You can't help it. You think, you know.
Well, I think the follow-up documentary was called "The Boy Can't Help It." Actually.
Yeah. Well, I can believe that because the sad thing with someone with Tourette's, if he sees a black guy in a mostly white area as well, he's gonna say it. He's going to say the word.
In the follow-up, the second follow-up documentary called I Swear I Can't Help It, he's in Matalan and he's queuing up to pay for his stuff. I think there's a Chinese woman in front of him.
Oh, God.
And he just... No, it's not when he's queuing up. It's when he's walking through Matlock. And he sees a Chinese woman. And he just shouts, Chinky!
You just know
sorry.
It.
Sorry.
Oh, my God.
But in some ways, that third documentary is the absolute best one. Because he's an adult. He's 37 years old. They go to this, like, away weekend, you know, where they all meet up for this, like, Tourette's weekend. And it's, you know, it's like a support group, peer support, that sort of thing. But he's got a mate called Chopper, who is fucking hilarious, right? And, anyway, I'm going to play you a bit from it, Dave. So
please.
I'll just play you the highlights, right? And I might interject just to tee up the clip.
This is fabulous.
Maybe I'll play a bit from John's Not Mad first and let it play out.
Perhaps because John is an adolescent, most of his involuntary outbursts are sexual, particularly if he sees a young woman. Then sometimes the outbursts seem more directed or focused. Here he tries to stop himself calling his mother a slut.
Choosy, I think. Got it. Slut!
He didn't quite manage that. Poor John. It must be the worst thing to have, really.
Well, I think what's interesting is that after the first one's only 30 minutes long as well.
Like, it is.
Know, it's a really short documentary, but it had a big impact on people. And then I think when you saw the second one, because it had that impact on people, so they watched it and wanted to know how he was getting on. You just had this. If you've got any heart, you had such a massive amount of empathy for him, didn't you? Because you just thought, you just really wanted him to overcome it and succeed, you know, get through it, because you could see it was torturous for him, you know. Mm. It must be, as funny as it initially was to any, like, school kid or whatever, you realise... It must, but how the hell do you live with that? Constantly blurting out crap at people all the time. You know.
Let me see if I can find the follow-up. Fucking hell, man. I thought I had this somewhere. Just bear with us.
Do you know what? They all go down this fucking route, though, don't they? I've just noticed it says John Davidson, MBE.
Yes.
You know. He said, meeting the queen when you've got Tourette's. Oh,
Queen.
Fuck off, cunt. Oh, bitch. Witch, cunt. Fucking old witch.
Illuminati.
Fucking lizard. Lizard, bitch. Oh, I wish I was there for that. That would be fucking great.
He probably got it through the post.
Fucking old wizard. Fucking old bitch.
Why isn't he dead yet?
Walking corpse. Fuck you. Bitch.
Oh, God, I can't find...
Lizard, fucking lizard.
Let me see if I can find this. Right, so, as I was saying, the third follow-up, third documentary, was called I Swear I Can't Help It.
Dude.
Someone very helpfully has... has done a compilation of the best bits.
The best bit of Sweary John.
Right. So, as I was saying, he attends this this weekend where he meets other Tourette's. And one of the best bits is when Heather from the Citizens Advice Bureau comes in to talk about disability benefits. Right. So anyway, listen to this. Fucking advert. Fuck off. Fuck off. Skip ads.
I'm trying my best to hold it in. Jargon, fuck off. Sorry.
Work is a 10-minute walk away from his home.
Hey! Fuck off. When we're together... We feel some kind of harmony, you know, there's a connection somewhere. Filthy fuck!
John's Tourette weekend gets underway with a relaxation session.
Picture in your mind a beautiful green field.
I'm up to my knees in fucking Copart.
Is there a wind? When you're ready, if you get up from the recliner.
Johnny Davidson.
Hello, I'm Heather from Citizens Advice Bureau in Gala Shields. That actually helped at all.
Fuck off, so, nosy.
Absolutely. And we sound as advisors like we're asking really nosy questions.
Did you hear that, Dave? That was shocking.
Fuck off, nosy. And I like the way he just dropped the little cunt in at the end.
Fuck off, nosy.
And she went, I am nosy. Yeah, he went, cunt.
Don't shoot the messenger. The next one is propriety of behaviour with other people. This person would be expected to tolerate the behaviour.
Fuck off!
Quiet. Burden for it. But there is somebody who's actually...
Your dogs get tests!
...in the law and thought it through at last. I'll leave that with you so that you can have a look at it.
You're very helpful.
Then there's more on. Does you mean it or not?
Did you hear that? Chopper blurted out, you're very helpful.
Yeah. 15 points of speech can't be understood by strangers.
I am young, we are young, we are young.
Absolutely. You get 9 points for strangers have great difficulty understanding speech.
Pakistanis and Iraqis.
You get...
Jesus.
Did you hear that?
Pakistanis and the lackeys.
No, she said, you get 9 points... for strangers not, or you not being able to understand strangers.
I know.
Johnny just goes, Pakistanis and Iraqis.
Pakistanis and Iraqis. I thought he said lackeys, Iraqis. Oh my God. That's fantastic. Yeah. Outrageous.
It's a really.
Oh yeah. Chopper's just said he gets stabby with knives.
Oh my God.
Slightly worrying.
Very worrying.
Benefits wise, you should be getting the maximum benefits because at any given moment you might need a minder. But you might not.
Arthur Bailey!
Quite right.
Just say anything that fucking comes into their head. Arthur Bailey! Oh,
she did say minder.
Minder.
That's
brilliant.
There's a great bit which I'll play now with. Chopper is his mate, Johnny's mate. He's saying, John's such a nice man. He hopes one day he'll meet someone who accepts and love him and loves him. But he can't resist a childish little remark at the end. See if you can spot it.
If he could meet somebody who could look beyond the Tourette's symptoms, that he would be able to find somebody that he could kind of get on with and settle down with.
Another gay man. There are also some.
Did you hear that?
Yeah. Another gay man. Another gay man.
Oh God.
Oh. Funny man. Yeah, it has to be said. It's funny.
Especially when we're having pub quizzes and stuff.
Well, the good thing is. Oh yes, yeah, talking about.
I mean, some of the stuff that they're saying, it's meant to be kind of funny as well. Yeah, they can't stop themselves.
They're all laughing at each other.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't feel so bad for laughing at it, because they find it funny. Here we go.
They're ever the person that stands up and has to act out what film it is or whatever, because I can't keep it to myself. You know, I'll stand up and I'll say, Jaws! Right, that's my turnover. oil on the road. Gonna crash!
Classic.
Absolutely brilliant, mate. That is such a great choice. So you do one more, and then I'll do my final one. But right. I'm going to mention some other things in the mix.
So my next choice is going to be a true crime documentary. And this was one I saw back in the 90s. And I only saw half of it because it was on one late Saturday night. And as soon as I started watching it, I was drawn in. And it's called Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills. And It covers the West Memphis Three case. Have you heard of that?
I have definitely heard of the West Offensive 3. Yeah.
So it's quite a famous case now, because it was proven to be like a massive miscarriage of justice.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, I watched this documentary, and at the end, one guy, I mean, it's three teenagers on trial for allegedly killing 3 8-year-old boys.
Yeah.
And one of them gets death row. That's Damien Eccles. He's sort of known as the ringleader of this group, even though they weren't a group at all, really. And the other two get like 40 odd years in prison. So when I watched it, it was like, okay, that's really shocking. And you forget about it. And because the internet wasn't about so much then, you can't do your old research, because I think this came out in 96. So, and I remember years later, I just remembered it and I thought, oh God, I wonder if I can find anything on that. And I didn't know what to search for. But eventually I found out more about it, and then found there was two subsequent documentaries about the case. But the reason I love this documentary is that it essentially gives you a fly on the wall experience of this case, right? And HBO, who made it, pretty much had full access to all the people involved in the trial, families of the victims, the accused, the police, the lawyers. So it sort of intercuts between, you know, clips of them. Now, what's so compelling is it's just this insight into this crazy fucking town in Bible Belt America.
Yeah.
Because it's in Arkansas, West Memphis, and its inhabitants, because seriously, it's just one after the other of crazy, weird looking characters. You know, there's just something about the way they look. I mean, there isn't a symmetrical face amongst them. And, you know, there's a fair few mullets about. And I understand Arkansas has got the fewest dentists per head. And that's pretty apparent. It's just like one bizarre character after the other. You know, and the families of the victims, they are like really, I don't want to say odd, because, you know, they're obviously going through a lot of things, but they do look pretty weird and they act pretty weird. The documentary itself starts off with police footage of them pulling out the bodies of the 3 8-year-old lads from the river.
Oh God.
Where they were eventually found, because they weren't found for a couple of days. But that's really shocking, because they're naked and you can see some injuries, and they've been hogtied with their arms tied to their feet.
Yeah,
and they're so obviously dead, and you don't usually see that. You know, I don't think I've ever, maybe up till that point, seen the body of a dead child.
No.
But what happens in the case? I mean, people may know or may not know about the case, but the police haven't really got much to go on, if anything, or they're just not doing the job correctly. But they end up arresting these three teenagers, and it soon gets out that they are looking at this case as part of a satanic ritual.
Yeah.
Okay. But they seem to have based that on just how these kids looked, you know. So a couple of them wear black. They're into metal. One of them's into Wicca. You know, he maybe looks a bit weird compared to other inhabitants of the town. But you can imagine the reaction to this. You know, the media go absolutely nuts about it, and there's all sorts of stuff being reported. I mean, there was one story which you hear one of the parents quote, saying that Damien Eccles had his son's testicles in a jar of alcohol, that the police found that. Right. But a lot of these stories apparently were leaked by the police. But anyway, the case goes to trial, and we see how that unfolds. And it's obvious that the prosecution have got their cases like as thin as an Aldi bin bag. You know, they've got they've got nothing. So they focus on this satanic aspect, this supposed satanic aspect, which isn't true anyway. The defense seems to put up good arguments, because, like I said, there's nothing linking these three boys to the boys that were killed. And, you know, if anything, the evidence points away from them, because there's absolutely no physical evidence that links them.
There's no real corroborating evidence, is there?
No. I think they just focus on trying to make out that they're Satanists. And yeah. It's like the jury and the media and the families of the victims, they've all got their fingers in their ears. You know, they're not hearing.
Yeah.
Not hearing facts. They're just hearing that these kids are evil. They're into Satan. Being Jimmy Swaggart country, it's...
Yeah.
That's like a huge thing for them. But at one point, the prosecution even cites Stephen King as being evidence of one of them being into Satan. You know, it just gets more ridiculous. I mean, the summing up of the prosecution says something like, well, is wearing black bad? No. Is listening to heavy metal music bad? No. Is having an interest in Wicca bad? Well, no. But if you put all the three of them together, you know, that means you're a fucking child killer, apparently.
This was a big thing that was brewing in the States through all these evangelical preachers, wasn't it? Yeah. These wandering bloody evangelists going around stirring the pot. And there's two or three famous ones, I think, that really stirred it so much so that they built up the fervour for the idea of the satanic panic, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost like a culmination of it, this, the fact that these guys, like you said, there was no link between the terrible, tragic murder of these kids to these boys.
No.
Yet this unbelievable sort of satanic fervour that was in the Bible Belt of America.
It's like hysteria. It was a wave of hysteria. Absolutely. But it was fueled by the media. I mean, you can imagine how the media got over this. It was just reporting shit after shit, you know. And
America's a divided country, isn't it? Because you've got like, you've got like the East Coast, which is really sophisticated and cosmopolitan and quite liberal-minded,
mm-hmm.
slightly leftist probably, but very cosmopolitan, free-thinking, kind of atheistic. And then you go down the South and it's all kind of voodoo, isn't it? You know, they're all buying into all the idea of heaven and hell and Satan and profiting on it. You know, this is the thing. There was a lot of like preachers who profited on the whole satanic panic crazy phase in American history because they were making seriously successful careers out of going around spouting off about this one whose name escapes me who was doing it and was claiming that he was involved in some kind of an occult and he managed to escape it and he was made to do all sorts of terrible things and killed people and all this kind of stuff and was freed by Jesus, you know, in the end.
Oh yeah, well everything's all right then, isn't it?
Exactly. No one questioned his past as well when he came out with all this nonsense. You know, it's hilarious, you know, absolutely hilarious.
Well, interestingly, Damien Eccles, who was known as the ringleader and the weirdest one, and to be fair, he does come across as quite weird at times in the documentary. But I think that was mainly because, what he said is that he thought the whole thing was a huge joke. So he played up to the boogeyman image a bit. He was 18. He just was being a bit of a dick at times. And also, he was probably heavily medicated because he did have... He was sectioned, I think, at one point in his teens. So he was quite a troubled kid. But he comes across as a very intelligent person. And one thing is really insightful is he said West Memphis is like Salem. Anything bad happens and people like him always get blamed. So it was almost like he was expecting this. He didn't think that he'd get sentenced to death at the end. You know, no, I don't think he was expecting that.
Yeah, it was like a witch trial, wasn't it?
Really? Yeah, it was, you know, exactly. Good. Yeah, it was. It was like a runaway train because once they sowed this seed of Satan and they were desperate to get someone. And you can understand the family's the victims, the parents, you know, because it was an absolute horrible thing that happened to these three boys. And the police were acting like they had the most solid case, you know, so...
Yeah.
As far as everybody in that town was concerned, they were all guilty. But... like I was saying about
before the trial even began, weren't they?
Yeah, it's like the trial was almost an irrelevance, you know. It's
trial by media.
Definitely trial by media.
Can I just say very quickly, the person I was referring to beforehand, this guy called Mike Warnke. Mm-hmm. And I became aware of him, and I meant to talk to you about this, Lee, because there's a good podcast on him through the last podcast on the left, guys, and they were claiming that he really was a big part of stirring the pot for the whole satanic panic. So it's a good listen, that, if anyone gets mm-hmm. a chance to have a listen to it. Because
yeah.
it links closely to this case, I think, in some ways. You know, just for the broader picture
of
things that pace.
But it's scary, like, you know, because, I mean, we had a bit of satanic panic in this country, didn't we, with, I think, Jersey and stuff. But when you see the end result, as this case demonstrated, it's really shocking. And you know, the documentary, it's really sad, and it's really melancholic, and it affects you. It affected me for a long time, and I still watch it, and I'm still affected by it, even though I've watched it quite a few times. And there's just this burning injustice of it all, and it drives you mad a bit. It's a bit like Making a Murderer, you know, watching that. But and another good thing about the documentary is it uses Metallica music really well, in fact. Not so much the heavy, fast stuff. That, brilliant. Actually, the link there is that the documentary makers, Bruce Sanofsky and Joel Berlinger, actually went on to make Some Kind of Monster, the Metallica documentary.
Right. Fantastic.
Which could be another contender.
It is a brilliant watch.
Yeah.
It's kind of tragic for Metallica in a way.
Yeah.
It's a great document, though.
Yeah, I mean, fair play to them, the fact that they let that go out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because, you know, they were revealing a lot of ego, you know, and they allowed that to go out there and stuff. And I thought that's pretty good of them, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
They were putting themselves out a bit there. It is at times hilarious. Very rarely is it intentionally hilarious, you know.
Exactly.
As a documentary. But it's a great documentary, though.
Yeah. The final thing to say about this documentary really is that if it hadn't have happened, these guys would have been, one of them would have been dead and the other two would have been in prison, because after it aired in the mid-90s, you know, everyone could see there was a huge miscarriage, and people like Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam got involved and were doing fundraisers, you know, to raise money to try and get these three out. And they didn't actually get out till about 17 years. And then it was on this weird plea bargain thing where they could maintain their innocence, but they had to admit that the state had enough to convict them. So I suppose it was a way of the state avoiding paying massive amounts of compensation. But
yeah, and public ridicule as well.
It was farcical, really. I mean,
terrible. You know, terrible.
That was But yeah, fantastic documentary. You can actually see it on YouTube in two parts.
I will be watching it, Lee. That sounds fantastic. And the only reason I do know a little bit about this case is because I've listened to it on podcasts again. You know, not that they need bloody plugging that much, because there's such a successful podcast. But again, last podcast on the left, I remember listening to their take on it
a few years
ago.
Another film came out which sort of steals the thunder a bit of Paradise Lost, because it was financed by Peter Jackson, the Lord of the Rings guy, West of Memphis. And that sums up the case from start to finish, from, you know, the trials until they get released. But I'd much prefer Paradise Lost.
That sounds great. And I, for one, am going to watch that, because, hands up, I haven't seen it.
It's an infuriating case, Dave. It's very similar to Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
Very similar, but a lot shorter.
Well, there lies the great rub with what we're talking about tonight, is we're talking about compact, perfectly put together one-off documentaries. And if I'm going to be critical of, say, something like Making a Murderer, which for a series was compelling and everyone got drawn into it, but my God, Netflix, they're not half good at bloody polishing a turd for hours and hours and hours, aren't they?
Yeah. You know,
they can make something that would be perfectly fabulous over 2.5-3 hours and stretch it over 9 episodes. And half the time you're thinking, you know, certainly at the end of it, you go, what the hell have I just learned there? You know, yeah, really? Dude, what have I just watched?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the second series, aren't you?
I gave up on it, mate. I watched about three episodes, two episodes, gave up.
I'm
not going to get drawn into it if I can.
I can't remember it that much about it, but it is inconclusive at the end.
Oh, yeah.
And it is infuriating. One contrasting example of that, and it was on Netflix, actually, and I thought was a really, really good documentary. And I did consider it for this list. And I think it was three episodes, which is very, very short for a Netflix doco series, was Don't Fuck With Cats.
That was all right.
Yeah, that was good. It was a really good story.
The Son of Sam one, too. I mean, but the Son of Sam
Yeah, the Son of Sam's was pretty good.
Pretty good, but maybe...
A bit long.
Maybe too long still. Two episodes too long. The Ripper one was quite good, three episodes.
Yeah.
But I'm so determined. If it's more than two episodes, you can fuck off because you're ripping us off. You're taking the piss. It's not that good. Mm. We all got dragged into that fucking Tiger King bullshit during lockdown.
Yes, yes.
It was nowhere near as good as people made it out to be. Mm. Louis Theroux did one and it was just as good. And it was like a one-off. Yeah. It's like piss off. Piss the fuck off with your fucking documentary series. That's why what we're doing here is great. This is documentary films. That you can go to.
One-offs.
One-off.
Pretty much.
John's Not Mad is half an hour fucking long.
Yeah.
And it lasted in our memory for 40 years.
Yeah. Right, so Dave, you have now got one choice left. Do you want to mention any further honourable mentions before you cover it?
Bloody hell, do I. I mean, again, like, documentaries may very well be our favourite genre in some way. Maybe, yeah. Because... the great thing with documentaries is we've got a love of films, we've got a love of true crime, we've got a love of the unexplained, we've got a love of history, and all that can come out in the best documentaries, and especially documentary films, not these overripe fucking miniseries. fuck, piss. You can fuck off. Thanks, John.
Overrated.
I'm going to mention a few things. Right, okay. I'm going to mention the Oscar winner from last year, which was My Octopus Teacher. That was going to be one of my choices because I thought it was brilliant when I watched it.
Octopus Teacher?
Yeah, it's amazing about this diver who almost like befriends this octopus and goes to see it all the time, every day in the water, and films it and finds out about its life over 12 months. And it's really, really touching and... you gain a great insight into the trials and tribulations of what an octopus has to go through over a year.
Okay.
So great.
Sounds good.
The other one, and this was another one I was really thinking I was going to pick, and it was kind of the inspiration to suggest let's do a documentaries podcast, was watching The Mystery of D.B. Cooper, which was a very recent documentary just last year, shown on through the Storyville umbrella. And it's a great film. I should imagine it got a limited cinema release. I think it was a HBO or something. And fascinating. Lots of different people talking about how they believe they knew who D.B. Cooper was before he made this crazy hijacking of a plane and then parachuted out of the plane with all the money. So it's a really great documentary. If you get a chance to see it, watch that. We mentioned Some Kind of Monster, Metallica, which is great. I wanted to mention, of course, as well, a couple of rockumentaries because I'm a big fan of, like, I get totally carried away with, like, my rock documentaries. Crossfire Hurricane about the Rolling Stones. That's a great little documentary, I thought. It was on telly the other night. It's really, really good. Get a chance to see that. Martin Scorsese's George Harrison, Living in the Real World. Living in the Material World, I should say. It's a great, very long, 3.5-hour documentary, but it's well worth a look. It's a labour of love by Scorsese. Even if you're not a massive fan of George Harrison, it's much broader, really, because, of course, culturally, the Beatles, even right up to, like, handmade films, you know, because he financed all those sort of handmade films.
With Neil and I.
Then I want to mention... Aleister Crowley, The Wickedest Man in the World, narrated by Brian Cox. A great little documentary.
I've not seen that. Which Brian Cox?
He's great, and it's a great documentary about the life and times of Aleister Crowley. I think, again, a Channel 4 documentary. So finally, this is going to be my final honourable mention, and it's the Poughkeepsie Shuffle, Tracing the French Connection, the Mark Kermode documentary about the making of the film The French Connection, which is great. Kermode's done a lot of really good film documentaries. That's no exception. It's brilliant. The one about Source was brilliant. The one about Straw Dogs is brilliant. The one about The Wicker Man is brilliant. The one about the Alien films is brilliant. You can't really go wrong.
The Exorcist one.
And you've led now to my final choice, Lee.
Oh, is it that?
My final choice is The Fear of God, Mark Kermode's documentary about The Exorcist. And the reason why I've chosen that in the end, and that has literally been my choice, I've made this choice tonight, right? Looking at all the other things, is because I wanted to put in a really good film documentary. And it's got a lovely little bit of history too, because I remember going out and buying it on VHS, not on DVD, VHS, with the Exorcist release. First time it had been released in years, let's remember that. And Mark Kermode's documentary was on that. And I remember enjoying the documentary as much as rewatching The Exorcist, because I hadn't seen it since I was 15. And I just thought it was a brilliant insight into the making of this fantastic film, with all the sort of supernatural mystery of things that took place during the making of it. And great interviews with the cast. And ultimately, of course, the maverick that William Friedkin is, talking about William Friedkin's crazy techniques to get people to do things the way he wanted them to do it. Yeah. Shooting pistols, dragging Ellen Burstyn across the bloody floor and putting her back out.
Yeah.
You know, spewing hot pea soup into Jason Miller's face. The gamut. Loving Max von Sydow go, I don't think you need to shoot them around me there, Billy. If you don't mind, Billy.
No, you're right. It's a brilliant documentary, and probably one of the, if the not best, film documentaries there is. I did think of Heart of Darkness. That was going to be...
Oh, that's a great documentary. I saw that in the pictures.
Contender. Did you?
I saw that in the pictures. Mm. I forgot that. I forgot even to mention that.
If someone sort of mentions The Exorcist, or we start talking about it again, I do go back to that documentary a lot.
Always.
And it was on BBC iPlayer for a bit, because I think you mentioned that on the DVD release, there's an edited version of it, and it cuts out the Mercedes McCambridge bits.
It does indeed, it does.
Which are very important. You think, very why important. The fuck did they cut them out? But
weird.
But when they put it back on iPlayer for a bit, it's probably gone now. It was restored, but I remember taping the original from the TV, so I have still got that.
I wonder whether there was some copyright or some problem there, because I think Mercedes McCambridge could be quite difficult. From what
Maybe she
was. Alcohol. And, yeah, I think there was some issue there, because it seemed odd. But, you know, whatever anyone thinks of Kermode, he has made some great film documentaries, none better than The Fear of God. I'm not saying it's the best out of my list. I'm not even saying this list is the best list. I could probably come on with you again tomorrow and make a completely different list. But I just, for tonight, I just thought, yes, I want to mention that as one of my documentaries, because it's brilliant. There's a great Stanley Kubrick documentary, for example. There's a great documentary about The Omen. There's so many great film documentaries out there. There's so many great rock documentaries out there, of course, because I mentioned a lot of them. But I just thought that The Fear of God is brilliant. Simple as that. It's a brilliant documentary, and I would recommend anyone who hasn't seen it to watch it.
Fantastic choice, Dave.
Thank you, sir.
If only I had thought of it. Right, so we're down to my final choice now, Dave, which you've pretty much guessed. An impossible job. Channel 4. Graham Taylor. It's a fascinating account of an England manager in crisis, and you know, the black comedy is up there with anything that I've ever seen. So this documentary, for people who don't know, it followed the England football manager, Graeme Taylor, as he tried to get England to qualify for the 1994 World Cup in America. And ultimately, it just shows how sort of amateurish the whole thing was. I mean, before this came out, I'm sure, like me, you probably thought that there was quite a lot of sophistication that went on.
Oh, sure, yeah.
In terms of the England setup and being the team manager, you know.
And it's a cliquey boys club football as well. It proved that, didn't it? The way the British FA was run at the time. Don't know if how different it is now, but it was pretty pathetic, really, wasn't it? the whole thing.
Another thing that came out of it, which surprised everyone, it was that Peter Swales, the Man City chairman, who was, you know, a failure doing that job, was actually the chairman of the FA.
He was
the chairman. And we were watching that and thought, what the fuck? Swales is the man in charge here. He's the one that appoints Graeme Taylor.
Peter Swales with his super comb over, like the most supersonic comb over I've ever seen in my life. It's incredible.
And his Cuban heels.
Yeah, this is it. So hang-ups galore there, weren't they? You know, like, I've got to make myself look bigger. I've got to make myself look like I've got hair.
God, it was the worst comb over ever. The parting was just at the back of his head, wasn't it? So he swept it back up.
Wow, what skill. I mean, the amount of, like, toxic fucking hairspray he must have used to hold that in place, for fuck's sake. Jesus.
Yeah. Another guy on the board was this football director called Charles. What was his name? It was the football merchant.
Yeah, I can't remember his name, but there was a lot of criticism about him, wasn't there? Because he was Mr. Amateur.
Yeah.
And he was like the head coach, wasn't he, or something? Wasn't he
It was something to do with, like, director of football.
So
he had a lot of influence over Taylor.
But he was like a school, but he was like, all he'd ever done in his life was like coach school kids, really. Somehow he managed to find his way to this top job in the England setup. Amazing.
And Taylor bought into his theories, didn't it, about long ball. And but it was such an eye-opener, wasn't it? I mean, it was fascinating from start to finish. You know, I mean, if you think back, Taylor came in after Bobby Robson, who left on a high note, really. He got England to the semi-finals of the World Cup. But he'd just had enough by then. And Taylor was in the right place at the right time, wasn't he? Because I think he just took Villa to second place in the league. And he had that success at Watford as well.
It had to be a little bit of a yes man, someone who was going to doff their cap a little bit to the FA.
Yeah.
This is what took place, didn't it? So Graeme Taylor fit that bill. He goes, oh, yes, I'll do that for you. Don't you worry about that. Yes, I'll sort that out for you.
But his first job was to get England to qualify for the Euro Championships or to which he did. And then we had a pretty disappointing tournament, didn't we, in 92. Which was the last time we saw Lineker and Beardsley play for England. Because
he didn't do himself any favours with that, really, because Lineker was only one away from matching Charlton's record. Is that correct, I think?
He
brought him off.
And he ended up bringing people like Andy Sinton and Carlton Palmer into the squad.
Carlton Palmer. God. It just said it all, really, didn't it? Andy Sinton and Carlton Palmer.
He was pretty much his linchpin, wasn't he, Palmer?
No, he looked. Carlton!
Carlton! We're losing the shape! Carlton! Tony! Just seems screaming. What's great about it is how close they get to Taylor when he's on the touchline. And it's so well edited. The camera is mainly right in front of the dugout, and you've got the Three Stooges, you've got Taylor, McMenemy and Phil Neal, who provide such comical,
hilarious
entertainment by basically doing nothing or repeating what Taylor says. They're just like parrots, aren't they?
Yeah.
But the other thing is, sometimes he's asking them for some advice. Well, what do you think we should do? Do you think we should move Gazza inside? And, well, I don't know, you're taking the risk there, Graham, you know. So it's not like any backup, really. It's all, it's on your head, this. You know, don't involve me. I'm just here.
I'm just going to sit on the bench and take my £3,000 to sit on the bench or whatever they pay in the fucker.
I mean, Laurie McMenemy, for God's sake. I know, wasn't he just a pisshead?
Just a total pisshead.
Oh, actually, didn't he advertise the alcohol-free?
He did.
Barbican. Maybe he's not a pisshead, I don't know. But he always looked like he was a pisshead.
A great lager. Hmm. Can't even remember how he talked.
Fuck Chris, give me some Carlsberg.
Give me a fucking pint of Stella, you twat.
But Phil Neal, though, he absolutely got slated quite rightly after that. But he said he was edited to look stupid. Well, I don't think they needed to try very hard, did they? Oh, God. But yeah, so the close-ups of them on the bench is fascinating to watch. And it's intercut with parts of the match. But it's just the camera on Taylor. I mean, he's so fucking shitting himself through most of the games, isn't it? Because he can see how little control he's got over what's happening on the pitch. And how he's picked the wrong players and how he's set them up wrong. And they're all like fucking running about not knowing what to do.
It is hilarious.
So thinking back, I think the first game in the qualifying, we drew 1-1 with Norway at Wembley. And I think we drew 2-2 with Holland. So we didn't get off to a great start. Oh, Turkey, I think we beat quite easily. So we got a few easy wins against Turkey and San Marino. But then we had these two away games, which were in Poland and Norway. And that takes up a lot of the documentary. In the Poland game, do you remember what happens in that? We go one down. Because Des Walker plays a hospital pass to Barnsley. What's Des doing? Oh, fucking hell. It's like, they're in. They go one up. And then with about 10 minutes to go, he puts Ian Wright on. And he's like, should we get Wrighty on? He's made for Wrighty, isn't it? Get Wrighty.
It's the way he seems so uncertain to what to do. And he's rubbing his chin and he's trying to... Oh, it's brilliant.
He's like, you know, tell me what to do, please. I've run out of ideas. Anyway, Wrighty rescues him with an equaliser.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's still a bit of a bad result, 1-1. And then a few days later, we have to play Norway. This, to me, is the best one. The camera is, like, quite low down, but you get, like, a really close-up view of Taylor's face. And some of the stuff he comes out with is absolutely brilliant.
It's pure televisual gold, mate.
Yeah. Because he's put Les Ferdinand up front because Shearer got injured, didn't he? Which was unfortunate, really. So he's got Les up there, big Les. The tactic is basically to just hoof the ball up to Les, right? So every time one of the midfielders gets
no finesse at all.
When one of the midfielders gets the ball, it's like, hit Les, run, go Les, go. And Les is like, oh, he can't get on the end of it or he's not getting the ball. And Taylor starts having a go at him. He's like, demand it, Les, demand it. Perhaps they can't see you. Fucking hell. So he really loses it. He really loses it in that match because we go 1-0 down. Because we switch off at a throw-in. Quick throw-in's taken. Des Walker to blame. Yeah, so they get 1-0 up. Gazza's having a nightmare. So Taylor and Black Menemy start having a go at Gascoigne from the bench, shouting, you're in there to deliver, pal. And then they score another one, so we lose 2-0. And that's pretty much the end of the campaign, barring a miracle.
It's pure pathos, because it is funny, but it's really sad as well. It's really tragic. You know,
well, yeah, I think at the time people ridiculed Taylor and said that he's made to look so stupid and shown up for the manager he is. You know, he's just not good enough for the job. But a lot went against him during that qualifying period. I mean, like I said, Shearer got injured. I think he lost Pierce for a bit, and Gascoigne. had a facial injury, and though he wore a mask in some of the matches, but he wasn't performing. And then we did get robbed a bit in that penultimate game against Holland, which was the do or die one. You know, when Koeman hauled down Platt when it was 0-0.
Yeah. I'm just seeing the documentary and his reactions.
Go on, Platty! Go on!
See what your mate did!
Koeman just cynically hauls him down. Straight red in anyone's book, but the referee doesn't send him off. He gives him a yellow card.
Yeah.
Much to the anger of Taylor and his bench. He's not even given a fucking penalty! Though it was outside the box, it has to be said. So, yeah, Koeman stays on the pitch. And then scores the free kick, doesn't he, in the second half?
So good. I mean, it's not good, obviously, an England fan, but anyway. In retrospect, he's so funny.
And then at the end of the match, when we're 2-0 down and there's no way back, he's like having a pop at the linesman, isn't it?
Breaking him in either, he's going, the lines.
Yeah.
Well, mate there.
Tell your mate, thanks very much. I've got the sack now. You know, thank him for me, won't you?
He's lost me my job, he has.
Yeah. It's beyond belief, that, isn't it?
It's so funny.
Just dead mardy. Thank him ever so much for me, won't you?
That is the thing with it all. He is kind of mardy and he gets really wound up like that. What's the thing with the guy? The guy in the press room.
Oh, yeah, Rob.
Rob, come on. Have put a smile on your face, Rob.
Rob, we can't have faces like yours around the place. Oh, I love the fact that all Rob's mates.
I know you care, but come on. We need a face. Can't have that.
I'm just worried. Well, don't worry, Rob. It'll be fine. But it wasn't. Because Rob got really upset about the reaction, the selection, didn't it?
Yeah,
Taylor's.
What is this?
For the first time in 20 years, we're playing five at the back. Yeah. What are you doing, Taylor? It's suicide. We're putting Carlton up front, putting Chris Woods in instead of David Seaman. What are you doing? He was so, I think Rob Shepherd was like a fan, wasn't it? A despairing fan.
Yeah. Absolutely. He was right to worry, because it was a horribly, horribly old school British. Organise your back. I mean, Southgate's a bit like that now in a way, but at least they play proper, like, triangles and proper football all the time. Mm. They're trying to. But what it does sometimes when you're constantly concerned about defending and looking good, you know, in your defence, you forget about what it is to go forward.
Yeah.
And I felt that was, you know, with all the success that England had in the last two tournaments, they were just sort of missing a trick, just being able to just turn on an extra gear, to do something.
Yeah.
Like all the Italy were able to do it, Croatia were able to do it. Suddenly just change gear.
Yeah, he fucked up for me, Southgate. But I think after the documentary came out and people saw it, some people, like I said, they ridiculed Taylor rightly because he comes across really inept and bad in it. Mm. But I think over time, people have started to see it was more to do with just the pressure of the job, because it's an absolute impossible job, as the title suggests. It's the scrutiny and the stick Bobby Robson got before him by the press, who seem to want the England manager to fail. And that carried on under Taylor.
I don't know whether, looking back on the time, and there was almost like an inevitability, because I think that the press, they didn't want him, did they? Nobody really wanted him as the manager.
Not after the Euros. I think he was the right man at the right time, or he was in the right place at the right time.
He made a big, bold move getting rid of two of the sort of heroes of Turin, if you like, and two of the players that had really helped Robson to some success in tournaments.
Well, that backfired on him massively, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. It really backfired on me. It was a bold move. It didn't work, because he's bringing in players that are just not in their league as well. That's the part of the problem, isn't it? He was bringing in players that just didn't, you know, workhorse old first division players, wasn't he?
Yeah,
you know, this is the thing. It was kind of unfortunate for Taylor in many ways, I think. But part of the problem is that documentary, the way it showed the coaching setup and the way it was edited, it's just brilliant. It does make them look really quite inept.
Well, I don't think it was a stitch-up job. What he was happy that it showed was the pressure of an England manager and how difficult it is. And the documentary maker has a lot of respect for Taylor. He said, you know, he's such a decent man, Graham Taylor. There's a few times in that documentary where he's defending John Barnes, because John Barnes was the target for the Boo Boys, if you remember.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And he hears something from the crowd, and Taylor just turns to speak to this person who shouted something. He says, hey, just remember, that's another human being you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I think he was a decent guy.
I've no doubt about it.
He was perhaps too nice for that job.
Maybe.
You know,
maybe.
He wasn't like, say, a Ferguson or, you know, someone that could shit the players up and use his power.
He probably fell in a difficult period too, where some of the better players were not 100%. Lineker and Beardsley, I suppose, were on the way. They were still good. And he probably made a mistake, and he did make a mistake in getting rid of them. They could have been great. Even if he hadn't played them for 90 minutes, they could have been really good impact players, couldn't they? Could have brought them on in the second half.
They've got the experience, which a lot of the players he was bringing in didn't have, really.
The whole rounded picture of that documentary is just a fascinating and kind of fabulous piece of entertainment. It really is. It's so good. I mean, McMenemy is such a drip in it. And Phil Neal looks like a moron, doesn't he? But actually, I think in a way, Taylor's trying. At least he's getting. I mean,
the thing they're doing nothing apart from
doing nothing. At least he's quite rightfully getting wound up and getting upset and getting aggravated, and that is funny. You know, that is sometimes quite funny to see people get like that. But you know, we've all been there.
It's very funny.
And perhaps the way he goes about it makes it kind of funny too.
Well, there's one bit in it where he appears to be giving McMenemy a lift home.
Yeah, exactly. McMenemy's just come, sat on the bench, going, oh, come on now, Graham. Oh, I agree with you, Graham. Oh, now, come with me, Graham. No, don't worry about that, Graham. You know, that's about it. That's all he does. And then he's getting a lift home.
probably
didn't even give him any money, or didn't even buy him a drink or anything.
He probably lived in Hampshire, didn't he? Because he was used to manage Southampton. So Taylor's like driving all that way, giving him
fucking miles.
Getting back at 3:30 in the morning.
Thanks for that, Graham. I'll have my license back in a few months. I wish I'd drank the fucking Barbican that night.
that's when they have the conversation about Gascoigne, which is quite funny, where they're going, now we've got to look after Gascoigne. The enemy's going, well, he's like a lead violinist, isn't he?
I say it,
George. He's a lead violinist.
Finely tuned. He's like, you're holding menu in there, Graham. You're not wrong there. Yeah, you're not wrong. Lovely. I mean, what a job it is to be an assistant manager or a coach. Just yes, man, you know, to these. You know, when you're in a job, you're in a position like Taylor, you're carrying the weight of it all, aren't you?
And exactly.
And I think that's
shied away from it, because they probably thought, oh, I'm not going to be my usual shit self on camera and show how bad I am at this job. I'm just going to say nothing.
Say nothing.
I'm not going to commit myself.
You're right, Graham. Why, hey, man, you're right, Graham. Phil Nelson, yeah, Graham, yeah, if you think so, yeah.
There's one
commitment, was there? No. Non-committal twats, the pair of them.
But there's one bit where Taylor's asking for some advice and McMenemy throws in, well, you've got to think about what the press are going to say.
Oh, my.
No, you don't. You do what you should do.
What the hell?
You can't be considering that. I suppose it shows how powerful the press were.
Well, it says it all about Lauren McMenemy.
Yeah, probably knew they had a bit of dirt on him.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to upset the press.
Yeah, you know, Graham, they know I go to that knocking shop in Southampton. So for God's sake.
I think I'm in Jimmy Savile's address book.
Yeah. I didn't mean to, but I was at a party there and he just said, take Cecilia up to the bedroom. I got carried away, Graham. in a way, looking back on that, really, when, especially when you've watched it two or three times, which, you know, we have.
Oh, yeah.
With hilarity. As much as Taylor looks a little bit out of his depth and at times a bit of a clown, he also, at times, has got quite a lot of dignity. And, you know...
Apart from that last match.
No, from that last match, yeah, exactly. You see him there? You see your pal? Cost me my job, it has. Yeah.
Should have sent fucking Koeman off.
What's going on, mate? But, yeah, he had got a lot of... quite a lot of dignity about him. I often thought that afterwards as well. After the whole debacle finished. You know, yeah. I felt for him a bit there, because I think he was a decent bloke. But the other two... They just look. Neil and McMenemy were shocking, weren't they? They offered nothing.
Why did he pick them? I mean,
well, know, that's true.
In some ways, manager, it's his own fault, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what they do. A lot of managers, you see, they do pick yes men rather than, you know, maybe Clough and Taylor, where they challenge each other and.
Well,
you know,
that was a proper team, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
It was really. Like Fergie and Steve McLaren, a proper team, really. Mm. I think it was kind of, there's a bit of good cop, bad cop. I think he knew that Steve was a nice guy. Yeah, he probably massaged Gary's
another
shoulders.
Another shit England manager there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So he's like, oh, hi, Gary, let me massage your shoulders before you go on today. Don't worry about what Fergie's got to say. Hello, don't worry.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Fergie, yeah, listen to me, Gary. You got to get out there. You got to fucking get in there. Yeah, like that.
Ferguson was always. I remember when Brian Kidd used to get loads of credit.
Well, Kidd the same. Have you seen that City documentary? Kidd just floats about like a ghost in the background.
Yeah. What he's there for, I don't know. He's retired now.
Just wear a fucking bubble coat.
That's yeah.
As Pep goes, listen, guys, listen. Okay, guys. For fuck's sake, guys, come on. We need to keep going. Pass the ball. Come on, guys. And Brian Kidd's there just going. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Listen to Pep. Fuck all. Hey, listen, guys. Who's this guy? Who's this ghost? Have you seen the ghost in the bubble coat, guys? Come on, guys. I've seen it.
But at the time when United started doing well in the 90s, you get people like Paddy Creran coming on the radio going, hey, don't underestimate the contribution of Brian Kidd. Right, but that really pissed Ferguson off, didn't it? He hated anybody else getting credit. And he wrote in his book, he had a chapter in his book, which was basically, Kidd did fuck all.
Kidd did fuck all. I'm sure he did do fuck all. He just massaged the egos of a few players.
I think he probably was more of an influence under Ferguson because he was the assistant manager. I think Kidd has been the assistant manager at City. He was caretaker manager after... Mancini got sacked for a bit and he lost virtually all the games.
Maybe they are.
Honestly. But yeah, so that's the number one documentary.
A great choice, Lee. Out of all the documentaries that we've spoken about, is the one that we can, this is going to be a hard question, that we can definitively say is between us our number one documentary. Tough one, isn't it?
It is, for sure. And I think obviously American listeners or any international listeners probably got nothing out of the last 15 minutes.
I love that documentary though, Lee. I think anyone into sports would get something out of that documentary. I think a sort of an American listener might not see the humor in it, but they would see the frustration and the behind the scenes element that would be quite kind of interesting and fascinating, because I'll watch sometimes a documentary about basketball or American football, but it is comedy gold. I mean, the thing is unintentional comedy gold.
This is it.
It's comedy gold.
That's why it's so good, because it wasn't the intention to expose the mockery of the England management.
No, it wasn't.
But it was just how events unfolded, and that's what makes a great documentary. That's similar to other documentaries we've mentioned tonight, is that sometimes a documentary will start off one thing and it'll become another thing, like the Paradise Lost documentary, like Capturing the Freedmans. That started off, it started off as like a guy was doing a documentary on clowns, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And one of the Freedman brothers, who was this professional clown, mentioned to him what had happened to his family, and that proved obviously to be the more compelling story.
Absolutely. No, that, I mean, that is a great documentary. Some of these YouTube documentaries are fantastic too. You know, some of the ones, the gentleman that you were talking about, whose work you can find on the BBC, that explores certain aspects of political life and sort of going down very dark rabbit holes to do with life, you know, banking, politics. What's the thing that you put me onto, the documentary?
It was called Can't Get It Out of My Head. It's Adam Curtis.
Adam Curtis, yeah.
He might not be that well known to people because his stuff just seems to appear on iPlayer. You know, they never seem to be shown on TV for some reason.
They don't. Well, they're too potent, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're the things that should be shown at prime time on like ITV or BBC, but they don't. They don't because he's telling the truth. He's telling the truth about the hideous world we live in. What I like about him, in a way, is he's an Oxbridge man, qualified BA from Oxford, but he's used that academia to, instead of going down the wrong path of the force, you know, he's trying to tell people what it's all about. This is what the world is all about. And it's too much for a lot of people. They don't want to listen.
It is. I think that's probably why they are hidden away on iPlayer.
Yeah.
And they're not even, you have to search, don't you? You have to search. Because they're not prominently featured.
It's one of those, it's like, oh my God, this guy's right, but what can I do about it? Nothing. So let's watch Anvil instead.
Everyone should watch Anvil.
Everyone should watch Anvil. And I think, because I was mulling over in my head, which is the one that I would recommend above all others, it might be Anvil. It's definitely one we both chose as well.
It's heartwarming to hear you say that. Because, like I said at the time, it did have a massive effect on me.
I loved it, yeah. Lee. I really absolutely great. Loved it as a documentary.
Yeah.
And I'm tempted to say Blue Tulip Rose Reed, in a way, as well. But John's Not Mad. They're all great. But the thing with that is, Anvil is a kind of element of, like, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, poking a bit of fun at them. But ultimately, they're heroes, you know.
Anvil was one of those bands that just put on this really amazing live performance.
They were a great band, yeah. I always liked Anvil.
In the summer of 1984, Anvil toured the world with the biggest bands in rock.
These guys are going to turn the music world upside down.
All of them sold millions of records around the world. All of them, but one.
One thing that's really good, man, is that we found those sleeping bags.
This is where we learned how to play.
Yeah. We're like brothers.
We were just innocent kids. We didn't really know what we were doing.
Crappy productions, crappy management.
My name is Tiziana Rigoni, manager at Anvil.
It looks like she's booked us a tour.
England, Belgium, Germany. This is going to be the biggest tour I've done in 20 years.
When I work at Choice Children's Catering, they don't know that my band even exists.
Welcome to Romania.
The place is jam-packed.
Given your reputation, you should be playing in front of 1,000 people every night, and you are not.
We missed our train.
Hi.
It's so unprofessional what we are going through.
Who's the guy that's supposed to pay me?
It's been nothing but a nightmare.
I try.
It's over. Been over for a long time.
It's so unfair to Anvil. It's so unfair to Anvil.
I stayed dedicated to what?
Rob, I don't want to fight with you.
Who's the closest person I got in the world?
I started out with Rob when I was 14 years old, and we said we're gonna do it till we're old men. We really meant that.
They should have made it a lot bigger.
I think even he knows at the end of the day, the family is what's important.
I always believed that no matter how hard it gets, there's always a way.
Let's show the world that they're wrong.
Anvil!
We're gonna do it together. We're gonna get there. We're gonna be rock stars. It's a dream, but I'm gonna make it come true.
So
Oh, there's cliffs I can go jump off. That's the easy way.
Well, you meant no. You won't jump off the cliff because I'll stop you.
That's dedication, pal.
Yeah, I'm going to say Anvil because it's in tune with that. Not giving up on your dreams, pursuing what you love. And it's an underdog. It's a story about the underdog. There's lots of documentaries about very successful people, you know.
You know, it's interesting that the two documentaries we've picked, the Taylor one and the Anvil one, they show people at their rawest, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're not airbrushed representations. These are
not at all.
These are real people in real moments suffering and so struggling.
Are you saying then that your favourite is the Taylor documentary?
Well, yeah. I mean, I did have it number one, but, you know, there's not much difference between all that I've picked.
Because I was viewing mine from, here's my five, and now I'm plucking the ripest cherry out of those five.
Yeah.
Because my final choice obviously was Mark Kermode's Exorcist documentary.
Yeah.
But I love it, and I've seen it many times, but just for the sheer joy and craftsmanship of that documentary, the Anvil one is number one for me.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's been a fantastic chat tonight. This podcast is going to be very long, but I hope our listeners stick with it. So if you want to, listeners, send in your choices and please let us know what you think of the podcast. Please rate us. We have had some reviews, which have been very nice. Yes, so thank you for anybody that's reviewed us. And be sure to tune in next time.
Absolutely. Good night. God bless.
I will be making changes to that.
You tell us back now. You can't wait that time and then expect to deliver that.